Blog Talk Radio.
Talking to you live from New York.
Another cyber interruptus. I was like,
I can't believe it.
I know.
I don't know. That robo secretary, I think she's going to be fired soon.
Yeah,
she went
on her cyber coffee break. I was thinking, okay, do we just jump in and start singing the theme? I mean, it could
happen.
I have
no idea. I know. I started to do that and then finally broke into I was just wondering. I had no idea. Did you see this new – are you looking at the studio board like I am? What is this invite guest co-host? Did you see that?
Oh, I don't know. They need to realize we're slow for change, okay? And they keep changing it up and making a lot of colors on there and everything. And Cynthia is so easily distracted by shiny things. It's not good for her. You know,
I need the old one.
Yeah, I'm old school, man. You know, the board is a little complicated, but we are on hi-fi now.
I know.
We are, yeah.
we're just into stereo soon, you know?
Part of the experiment that they're doing now for hi-fi. Well, apparently hi-fi is a little slow at the switch because they better be getting on to the thing faster. You never realize how long 10 seconds is until you're looking at a countdown and nothing's happening.
Dead air.
Lovely.
I know. Well, I just want to say I'm glad to be back, but I'm going to be heading back out to Liverpool again. I had a great time. Frida Kelly, she's great. We had such a wonderful time. She had a couple hundred guests, some of them old band members. I mean, seriously, you know, the Mersey Beats, people that she knew from way back when, they were all there, and some people got up to perform. It was great. I enjoyed myself immensely. I love Liverpool. It's always been one of my favorite cities. The people are great. You know, it's that like Southern hospitality. You know, they open up their doors and invite you in. And I had a great time. I really did. Weather, I could do without. Oh, I got to stay in what I call my room at the Hard Day's Night Hotel because Shannon, you know, Shannon is an amazing artist. She did 110 original paintings throughout the whole hotel, and there's one that includes me in it, and that's the one.
The
Maypang room. It was great. It was good fun. Had a great time.
I saw the picture on Facebook. Well, of course, and for people who don't know, Frida was the original Beatles fan club president, and
she ran the club. She was the second one, but she was the one that she was actually Brian Epstein's secretary, and then took over the job of answering the fan club and just took it on, and it was great. She's a lovely lady. We had such a great time, and she looks so beautiful.
And they've done a documentary about her, right? Isn't it?
Yes,
Good Old Frida. Yeah.
It was good.
Wow. She looks pretty darn good. I'll tell you
she
what.
She looks great. Yeah.
I know.
And we had
What's
such
she
a
drinking?
Great time. I don't know, but you know what? My friend Alan came up also with my graphic designer who did my website, Billy, and we also went out for our. It was the last night we had a meal and took Frida out, and of course we saw. I got to be careful. There was a ship. I have to say ship, not a boat, because Alan gets upset, and you know he always goes, "It's not a boat, it's a ship." And it was moored and it was just leaving, and we had fireworks, and the restaurant we were at was high up, and we had a panoramic view. It was wonderful.
Oh,
it was great.
Nice.
It was
nice.
Like I said.
I was back here in the sweltering Tennessee heat, as only Tennessee can get. And
well, I'd go back to Liverpool soon too.
Yeah, it was. It's been hot. It's going to continue to be hot, but it is summer here, and it's part of it. And in Tennessee, there are more species of spiders, I think, than anywhere in the world. And they get pretty darn cocky this time of the year. It's like, hey, hi, how you doing? And it's like you walk out into a web. It's scary, creepy. And it actually is a wonderful segue into our guest today. Yeah. I'm so excited because, first of all, you know, I love my horror and I love my scary and all things alien. I need to talk to him about doing something about aliens. But son and your daughter are into all these Comic Cons and they do the cosplay and all that. My son actually went to Comic Con because he was in Fantastic Four, so he got to go legitimately. And he came back and he said, "Mom, I think 2 days would have been enough." But we've had director Mick Garris on here before, and he's such a classic overachiever. He's one of these guys who you just know by looking at him, everybody likes him. He's a nice guy, and I think that gets him through doors that people ordinarily wouldn't get through. But his family, not just him, have had an incredible couple of years. His father-in-law was Louis Zamperini of Unbroken fame. Just to be associated with that life, that film, and then on top of it, Mick, with his own history, he's a director, he's an author, he's a filmmaker. Oh, and a little bird told me he has a band, too. We'd like to
Back. I mean, really.
Yeah.
He's got
Scary
it all.
Guy, Mick Garris. Mick, welcome back to the show.
Yeah.
Oh, thanks. Let's talk more about Liverpool.
I love Liverpool. You know, it's a great place to be. Have you not been there?
I was there once in the 70s. You know, yeah. I mean, anybody who was in a band back in those days was in a band because of the Beatles, anyway. But I paid homage in Liverpool and went to the Cavern Club and all that stuff because I was in a band. I was a music journalist for a few years and all that stuff. So
well, I'm going back because there's International Beatles Week at the end of August.
Nice.
And for a week, and I'm one of the guest speakers. Donovan's going to be there, Peter Asher, Patty Boyd, myself. You know, so we're going to be out there. Come on by, come on out there, come join us.
Okay, just open a big suitcase for me and sneak me through.
Hey, yeah, that'll be great. Invite everybody. Cynthia will be the first one in, I'll tell you.
Yeah, there you go. I don't need a big suitcase. I'm small. I can fit in a little carry-on. Oh. Well, maybe not a carry-on. Okay, but anyway, Mick.
Petite.
But I don't even know where to begin with you because now I stalk you on Facebook. I know, were you just up in Vancouver shooting something?
I was in Toronto shooting an episode of a new series called Shadow Hunters, which is based on a series of books, a YA series of books, The Mortal Instruments. There was one movie called Mortal Instruments, City of Bones, a year or two ago, and they're following it up with a new series. So I got to direct the second episode of it and had a great time doing it.
Now it'll be on TV? Is that, it's a release for television?
Yeah, it's a series that... It's a series, and I think it doesn't come on until January on the ABC Family Network, of all places, to find my work. Everything I do is family material, if you're in the Manson family, I guess.
There you go. Hey, listen, it's all relative. What's scary to one is, you know, not to another. But, you know, when it comes to horror... because I, first of all, your history with Stephen King, your work is what I look at as more psychological horror. There's blood, there's gore, but it's not like you don't do slasher films. It's not like it's cutting people up for the sake of cutting them up. Do you think that the audience has become numb to violence and horror?
I think a certain level of the audience has. I mean, there are so many different ways to describe horror. It's such a wide umbrella. For me, just stalking and slashing and splattering red all over the screen is not necessarily entertainment or something that I'm particularly into. But I do believe that a show like Hannibal is unbelievably gruesome, but artfully and beautifully so. I certainly don't believe in censorship of any kind, but I do lean much more towards storytelling than blood spattering. And if the story being told justifies all of that violence or brutality, and I've done some and am going to embark on probably one of the most brutal things I've ever worked on, but it's motivated by the story. And to me, as someone who started as a writer, the story and characters are really paramount to everything else. It's, you know, good horror is first good drama to me, because it's all Shakespeare as far as I'm concerned.
Yeah, right. And there is something, there's something about a mindset of, why do we like to be scared? And I think it's because we know we can walk away from it, that we can check in and check out. We don't have to stay in it. You know, it's not a reality to us. And I think that that's like a control thing for people, you know.
No, I think that's a really good point. Yeah, I think that's a really good point. I think it's horror is good for you because you can play touch with your fears and not die, you know. You can experience your fears in a comfortable way. It's the same way, you know, the old analogy with the roller coaster. You get on and it's scary, but you know you're going to be safe when you get off. But it's also, particularly to younger people, it's sort of a test, you know. It's like, can you take this, watch this movie? Mm-hmm. and there's a great deal of whistling past the graveyard, but for adolescents, people in their 20s, you know, they think of themselves as immortal, and they think, you know, the body is a temple. You know, the body is meat in movies like this, and it's really fun to laugh in the face of death or mortality. And when you're 19 years old, you want to embrace something that your parents would be horrified by. You want to say, I love heavy metal. I love this guy's throat being slashed and his eyes being punched out. And mom and dad aren't going to like that a bit. Great. I love this feeling of immortality that you have when you're 19 years old, you know.
It is a power, and it's and like I said, you can check out, you know. You can turn it off. You know, or you can now you can go back to it. And you know, it's funny because I came to, I'm technically challenged. May has to, like, you know, tutor me through cleaning out my, you know, cookies and all that, you know, not the edible kind.
Mm-hmm.
And I just discovered.
Yeah, I could help you with those.
Netflix. I just discovered Netflix, right? Well,
you're late to the party.
Really? I know. Well, I'm always there when the streamers are falling down, you know, and the heels are broken. But I never realized just how many movies get made that are never seen, you know, that go straight to, you know.
DVDs and everything else.
Yeah.
Right.
Well, that's
well, particularly today.
Yeah.
You know, particularly today, because the tools to make a very professional quality movie are in everybody's hands with their MacBook and their iPhone. You know, there's a great new movie, independent movie called Tangerine, that I just saw a week or so ago, and it was shot on an iPhone 5S, and it's great. I saw it at a big movie theater here in LA, and it's a terrific movie. It feels gritty, but in a good way. It was intentionally, they could have used more expensive cameras if they wanted to, but it really works for the storytelling of kind of a squalid, you know, it's about transsexual prostitutes here in Hollywood, and it's a really smart, really beautifully made film, a very human film, and everybody has those tools. They can shoot it with their phone, they can edit it on their laptops, they can do sound mixes and score it with, you know, everything your Apple products are made for, and you can come out with something that's more professional than a lot of things that were in theaters in the 70s and 80s, you know.
Right.
I mean, I'm just going to throw one out there to you that I happen to catch called Jughead, okay?
Oh, yeah.
I don't know if you're familiar with that film, but...
Oh, I saw it, yeah.
I was like, who sat in this editing room, like after the first day shooting, who sat and looked at each other and said, man, we're making a movie here? It's like, what?
You know? Yeah.
But
yep.
Then I say, Nick, they made a movie. You know, so
they made a movie, and it got out there, and people saw it, and it had several of the reviews on that movie were quite good. But you know, you can make them, and if you can find an audience for it, you know, you can make them successfully, and then make another one.
You know, those chiller conventions that I've even attended. I mean, you
the fans that come through there, they know every grade B, C, D actor, and they know all
yep.
of them, and they go there and they go, oh, he was in this and she was in that. It's amazing to see these people that know everybody. I don't know them. I walk in the room and said, what movie have they appeared in? They rattle off this list, and I'm amazed. I really am. So
well, it's just like music fans. They have an exhaustive
right.
Capacity for what they love, and it's really a great thing. You know, when I was a kid, I was kind of a loner. I liked horror movies, and nobody else I knew did. I knew there was a magazine out there called Famous Monsters that I would read, so somebody else liked this stuff. The movies never came to my local theater, but. A lot of the people drawn to this genre are outsiders, particularly in their wonder years, you know?
Right.
And this is something that brings them, they can feel an affinity towards it. You know, they feel like the monster. They feel like the werewolf going through changes and sprouting hair in places they never had it before. And all of this metamorphosis is taking place. It's a sense of alienation, but the you know, horror fans seem to be people who want to possess the movies. You know, they own the physical media rather than just stream it once. And mm-hmm. you know, they feel that it's a personal attachment and belongs to them. And so, yeah, they're the ones who go out there. You don't have Western conventions. You don't have comedy conventions. You know, you don't have detective movie conventions. You have horror and sci-fi conventions.
And I think part of it comes from the fact that it really, truly all movie making is make-believe. Let's face it, you can pretend to be a pirate, a princess, you know, a king, a queen, but horror
yeah.
movies really are pretend. You know, they're more pretend than any of the other ones because everything has to go so far to an extreme, the scariness, the violence, the music, the, and yet, you know, there's things about horror movies that every single one of us recall, like the from Psycho or, you know, it stays with you, whereas I couldn't whistle a tune from very many Westerns to you right now, you know, so that's really,
no.
really true. It's a whole different association.
But also, the more realistically it's played, the harder it hits home. And if you can share fears that are universal, you figure as a horror writer or filmmaker or actor or whatever, if you touch on something that feels real to you, that hits you in a place where you really feel it, then somebody else is going to share that feeling with you. And another great thing about horror films, too, is that they don't rely on expensive stars and necessarily on expensive visual effects and things like that. If you tell a really good, really scary tale, connects with somebody, it can just be good actors that you've never seen before and that don't cost anything. So
exactly.
It's one reason why there's such a proliferation of genre films, because they don't cost much. So the good news is that anybody can make a movie or a horror movie. The bad news is that anybody can make a movie. So you get a lot of stuff out there from people. You know, it's not
yeah.
a democracy. It's a meritocracy.
No.
So.
And it's so, you know, back in the old days, you know, back when I was doing stunts and the independent films were really independent, where we showed up with no permit, we shot something real fast and we left, you know, no studios
right.
were involved.
Mm-hmm.
It was true jungle warfare movie making. Now that independent thing is morphed into something else, you know, and it's become something else. But I think there's something to be said to have the capability of having people, once again, put what they really know is factual and true aside and believe disbelief and say, okay, I was really
right.
scared and this could really happen. And that takes a different kind of horror person. It does. And you are more in that genre. Not that I'm trying to pet you or anything, but you are.
Well, no. What appeals to me is something that feels like it could be real. That's, I think, one of the things that attracts me so much about Stephen King's work is that it's set in a very real world that we all live in. And the suspension of disbelief takes some good storytelling if you're going to do something hyper-real or beyond real or supernatural, but it's couched in natural and real-world terms, then it's going to be, for me, much more powerful.
And so much of horror is done at night, But a lot of Stephen King's work is not, you know, and the actual scenery is much as much a part of the story as the story. So it really takes some thinking. And I think that for me, I don't necessarily want to check your brains at the box office horror movie. I want to be paying attention. I want to be thinking, okay, you know, I don't want to be saying, why are you going down the cellar stairs? We all know no one goes down the cellar stairs. Stop.
Ooh, the light went out. Yeah.
Yeah. You know, let's just for one second, we got to talk about Unbroken. We have to.
Sure.
You know, I can't imagine as a family for all of you to have been able to, because now Louis Zamperini was your father-in-law. Is that correct?
That's right. Yeah.
Yeah.
So, I've been
what
around him for 30 some years. Yeah.
Whoa.
He was an amazing guy. And, you know, he passed away just almost exactly a year ago at the age of 97.
Wow.
And
wow.
I had started working on getting the movie of his life made like 17 years before it came out. And it took lots of different directors were attached, different screenwriters were attached, and it went through a metamorphosis. But really what happened was Laura Hillenbrand decided her next book after Seabiscuit was going to be about Lou. And she had come across his name several times when researching Seabiscuit, because they would compare him as an Olympic runner, as a track star, to Seabiscuit and the odds that they faced. And so she spent 7 years researching and writing the book. And when it came out, it was like hugely successful. It's still one of the most successful nonfiction books ever. And that's what got Universal off their collective asses and realized it's time to make this movie. And when Angelina Jolie read the book, she fought to get that movie to direct. And there could not have been a better choice. Over the years, you know, we talked to Steven Spielberg and to Ron Howard and various people. But Angelina had so much passion.
I was just going to say passion, right?
Passion, and that movie, more than any other movie based on real life I've seen, is absolutely true. Everything in that movie, with the exception of maybe one or two brief moments that were overly dramatized, everything that happened in that movie happened in Lou's life. And
wow.
It was a remarkable experience. And he never got to see the finished film, but he saw most of it. Oh. Angelina actually brought it in on her laptop and showed it to him in the hospital before he passed away.
What did he think, Mick? Can we ask? I mean, is that all right for him?
Yeah,
yeah. He
loved it. And he and Angie had just this incredible, almost a romance. They could see each other's homes. You know, he had this place in the Hollywood Hills that they'd lived in since the 50s. And so when Brad and Angelina came up to visit him for the first time, they drove up to the house. They said, well, we had no idea it would be a 1 minute drive. And then Louis's wife used to look and see, oh, the lights are on down at Brad's house. He's home. So,
that is adorable.
Yeah. So anyway, she and Louis got to be very close, and you know, she would make phone calls to him, you know, what was the color of the running shorts you used at Torrance High School, and how were they made, and all this, and she would run things past them. So the veracity of that film is incredible.
So it's as much about him as, and he's in it. He was part of it. He was part of what put it together. And I just
absolutely
think, I watched like footage of you guys at the premieres and everything. And I can't even, when you say beaming, that didn't even come close to what everybody looked like in the photos. It was, wow.
It was pretty
The film
exciting.
Was incredible.
Yeah, it was great.
The film was incredible.
Oh,
and I think that in this time when we have so much anger on this planet and so much hostility, to watch some of these films and realize, hang on a second, there is one common thing that human beings all share. There is. There is a goodness in every single one of them, and there is a survival instinct to want to make it to see the next day. And I think that that film, it was incredible. Kudos to your family. Kudos.
Well, thank you. And Angelina really is responsible for that, because she was such a driving force. She really wanted to tell that story. And she was just an unbelievable director. And she really made that happen. You know, it took 17 years of trying to make it go. But 17-year
overnight sensation. Wow.
Yeah, exactly.
Man.
Wow. So,
all right, let's talk about your book, Nick. Because, you know, I mean, we're running out of time.
Okay.
We got to talk about the book now. Don't. Okay.
Okay. Well, the most recent one, Salome, it's not a horror book, although it gets horrific in places. It's kind of a Hollywood desert noir murder mystery. And it's kind of amazing how well received it's been. It's, you know, not a big press. You can't go to your local Barnes & Noble and find it. But it's had a fairly limited run of special editions. But I think they pretty much sold it out. I think there are a couple of copies left on Amazon. But it was an amazing experience. It is my sixth book, but my second novel.
Wow.
Okay. In your spare time. See, he's an overachiever.
Yeah,
yeah.
Really?
Yeah, let's get him with a shoe.
Somebody needs to do something, you know?
Well, I know you have things coming up, and we can't tip the hand too much, but the Mick Garris Scary Machine marches on, and...
we can hint at a couple of the things. Yeah.
You gotta, well, I know this Masters of Horror thing that you had on, it's really really cool, and I have a lot of friends who are horror illustrators, so they're really into it.
Mm-hmm.
And I know you kind of mentioned that that may kick back up. We're hoping for that.
You were talking about the interview show, interview show. And we are in talks, and it looks like there will be a batch of new ones. But all of the ones I did just a couple of years ago, as well as some that I did over 30 years ago, some of them with the same people for the old Z Channel here in LA, I've posted everything for free online on a site called mickgarrisinterviews.com. And they're all there. But there are going to be new ones. And we're on the verge of that. And then we're still having meetings about other potential anthology things, and I'm working on doing some work around the world in different parts of the world that I've kind of made a career decision to do things that are outside the box, outside my comfort zone, just to keep evolving. And
right.
You know,
and
it's an
do you
exciting
have to hang
time
upside down in
that.
A cave to sleep. I mean, do you ever sleep?
I'm not good at sleeping, but fortunately I work quickly.
Yikes. Oh, man.
Yeah, but it's really hard to type upside down. So.
Yikes. Well, listen, we're running out of time, but we hope we want to have you back when you have some other stuff to talk about. I know all my horror.
You got it. Well, we'll have something in a couple of months. Yeah.
Oh, good.
Awesome.
I'm looking
That'd
forward
so
to that.
That's so cool.
Yep.
All right,
excellent.
Nick. Get
well, it's
Karen.
Always great to
Go
talk
on.
To you guys.
Take care.
You too. Thank
you.
See you in Liverpool.
Okay, that's good. You got it.
Bye-bye.
I'll be seeing him as part of a band up there soon.
Yeah.
Oh my goodness.
Yeah, he's probably on his. He's probably got a pen in his hand writing something as we speak.
I know exactly. So. Oh well. Anyway, that
was what
great.
A great guy though. What a great Idiot. Guy, and so willing to talk about his genre and about his work. And you know, you don't get a lot of directors who really want to do that. They'll talk about themselves, but he wants to talk about everybody else. See?
Yeah.
We have
he's,
cool
he's,
friends.
Yeah, he's really cool.
Yeah,
and,
well, our big thanks to Gary
there.
Raychak, our agent,
yep.
for setting that up, because he and Mick are friends. And he does have the hour. Yeah, we'll play a little of his music as we go out. So.
As we go out. Well, anyway. We're down to our last final seconds, and I'm surprised we don't have our robo secretary coming back up on us, you know?
Yeah, yeah. cyber secretary. She's fired.
I know.
Yeah, I know.
But anyway, I will, let's see, this, you know, I did a book signing. I did a whole bunch of things. The minute I got off the plane, I hit the ground running. I'm exhausted. So I'm going to go take a rest.
You go take a you go get carried away by Calgon. And we've got Jack Douglas next week. So
yes.
We have another good show coming up. All right, so here
Absolutely.
Is Mick Garris' song, Underneath. Everybody have a great week. You've been listening.
Right.
Blog Talk Radio.
Underneath the sidewalk, there's another world. Oh,